May it please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, representing the defendant appellant, Carlos Solani, in this criminal appeal. And, Your Honors, we've briefed three issues in our opening brief, and we're still standing by all three, but I want to focus this morning on the first and second issue in my argument. Certainly, I would take any questions the panel may have about any of the three issues. But discussing them in the order in which they're briefed, the first issue has to do with the court's decision to join the two robbery cases. One was the far more serious aggravated robbery, which was the incident down on South University Boulevard about 10:15 in the evening. And I said much more serious because in that case, there was a weapon involved. The other being the earlier, I refer to it as the simple robbery on South Parker Road. And I think that was about 9 o'clock. So it was about an hour and 15 minutes before the later incident. And the way the cases were charged, the more serious incident was actually filed. That case was filed in 2008. And the other case, the less serious robbery, was in 2009. Your Honors, it's our position that the court, amongst other things, erred in joining these two cases for trial. And I cite in our brief Brown versus District Court, in which the Supreme Court said, whether offenses could have been joined in a single information depends on whether all of the offenses were of the same or similar character and were tied together in a single scheme or plan. That's in the conjunctive. And one thing that was significant in our case is when the trial judge ruled on the motion to join the cases, the judge made a specific determination, and it's in the transcript, page 274. The judge said in the two cases, quote, the acts are in fact part of a common scheme, even though they were committed at different times and different locations. That's all well, fine, and good at that point, but at the time of my client's sentencing, the court said something we submit diametrically different. The court said that at the time of sentencing, the court labeled these separate episodes. And that's significant because the court then went on to sentence my client to consecutive sentences because they were different episodes. So it's our position it can't be both ways. And it's our position, it's been our position all along that they were separate episodes, and that's why they shouldn't have been joined.
You're not appealing the consecutive sentence?
No, and you know, in hindsight, maybe it should have been appealed. But I think the court still could have had discretionary, could have made them consecutive anyway. It would have been a matter of discretion, but the court did focus at the time of sentencing on the fact that they were separate episodes.
Well, Mr. Borquez, my concern here is that you might be conflating two different concepts, and one would be for purposes of sentencing, what would justify consecutive sentencing if there are separate episodes or separate acts, as a different standard may be applied to joinder of charges. So have you looked at that? Can you tell me why it would be the same analysis?
I have looked very, very briefly at it, but I think that the trial court could have, at the time of sentencing, said, I'm going to sentence to consecutive sentences because there were two different victims. I think the court could have done that. But I think by referring to these, looking at these as separate episodes, it undercuts what the court said at the time that the cases were combined. It's inconsistent.
But why isn't it more important for us to look at the actual facts in the case, including the testimony of, and I don't know if it was the current wife or the ex-wife, but you know, there was some testimony to the effect that the defendant himself admitted that he was on a crime spree. So he himself combined these events,
well,
by calling them a crime spree.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. And indeed, there were a number of statements attributed to my client that are problematic for me here today to discuss. But just because my client labels it a crime spree, I mean, my client may have called his entire life a crime spree, and I don't think that opens the door to everything and anything he's ever done. So I think we have to take it for what it's worth. Just because he labels it a crime spree doesn't mean it is, in the legal definition, a crime spree.
Well, it's still something that the trial court could consider, though, and we're reviewing for an abuse of discretion, are we not?
It is, but I think that we also have to consider the trial court's own words. and how the trial court viewed this differently by the time of sentencing. And they are different episodes. Granted, they were only an hour and 15 minutes apart in time. They were different parts of the county. All right, I think significantly, one involved a weapon and one did not. One was basically bad behavior at a convenience store. All right, the other was a lot more serious. It was a lot worse. And I think I understand, you know, one of the requirements I have to show is that there was prejudice.
No, please.
And I was waiting for somebody to ask me about that one. The people take the position that the aggravated robbery was a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. We do not concede that it was overwhelming evidence of guilt. There was evidence, clearly, that implicated my client. There was the testimony of the two wives. They're both ex-wives now, obviously. But I think one was already an ex. One was definitely an ex-wife, and the other one he was separated from. There was testimony from the wives, but you know, estranged spouses are estranged spouses, and they're not beyond being impeached by the fact that there's some kind of animosity between them and the defendant. There was also the unexplained presence of the briefcases in my client's motel room. That's bad, but you know, there are other explanations for that other than the fact that my client took them from SK at knife point. It's conceivable a jury could have concluded that my client, you know, purchased stolen property from somebody else. I mean, there are other plausible explanations for that. So, you know, I think it's significant that SK could not make an identification of the defendant, you know, a matter of days or within a week or two after this happened. It was an in-person walk-up or lineup that he couldn't make the identification in. There was also a voice-up in which my client and other subjects were asked to recite something. Couldn't make an identification there. But combining that, which is a weak eyewitness ID case, with what I submit was a very strong eyewitness ID case, that being the MH case, the South Parker Road case, I think it prejudiced my client. If there are no other questions about that issue, I can move on to the second issue. And that has to do with the admission of all the testimony about what I refer to as the animal hospital incident. And in reading the transcript in this case, it seemed like almost the bulk of the first day of testimony had to do with the animal hospital incident. And I think that started at 5 o'clock and it may have ended at 7 p.m. But it was late afternoon, and there were harassing phone calls between my client and his now ex-wife. And they were nasty calls, that's conceded. And, you know, they were even threatening calls. And it was totally inappropriate. It was wrong, and he was prosecuted in municipal court for it. It had very little to do with the case, the South Parker Road case, or the South University Boulevard case. And it's our position that the court erred in admitting this as res gestae. In order for this to be res gestae, it has to either be an integral part of the robbery cases, or it was necessary for the jury to hear about the animal hospital incident in order to understand either robbery case. And I think what the panel needs to look at is, could these robbery cases, without the animal hospital incident, be viewed by a jury and understood? And I would submit that yes, the answer is yes. Because the robbery cases were simply robbery cases. One involved a weapon, one didn't. But the animal hospital incident was basically a man who was apparently experiencing domestic issues with his spouse and venting and acting completely inappropriately and in an extreme manner. It wasn't a robbery that took place.
Well, Mr. Borges, even if we were to agree with you that it really didn't qualify as res gestae, the point I'd like you to get to would be prejudice. And just earlier you were saying that one of the two robberies was a strong identification case. So I'd like you to address the prejudice to that and then the prejudice to the other robbery.
All right, from the animal hospital incident and how it would prejudice him? Well, I think it was a piling on, Your Honor, of bad character evidence. I mean, there was enough. The prosecution clearly had enough evidence to make out a prima facie case on each robbery, all right? This was simply pouring more bad character evidence onto my client. And I think that's how he was prejudiced. It just portrayed him as a very unstable, violent, threatening person. I don't know if that answers your question.
Why is that information, you know, what happened at the hospital, any more harmful than his own or his own alleged description of this as a crime spree?
Well, I think that certainly his wife could testify to his labeling this a crime spree, all right? But this is just pouring more bad character evidence onto what's already there. So, any other questions? With that, I'd reserve, we'd ask that the panel reverse his conviction, remand for a new trial, and I would just reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. This case is about Carlos Solani's self-described crime spree on June 17, 2008, and this court should affirm his convictions because the joinder was proper, the race justi evidence was properly admitted, and the prosecution properly argued its case. Now, with respect to joinder, the Colorado Supreme Court has repeatedly held that joinder is proper when the criminal episodes form part of a schematic whole. Frankly, the people cannot fathom a better description of a schematic whole than a crime spree, and that is exactly what the record in this case shows. The robberies were committed within an hour of one another, approximately 12 miles away from each other, and both involved similar threats to kill the victims. In the simple robbery case where Solani stole MH's cell phone, he said, if you tell anyone, I'll fucking kill you. Similarly, when he robbed SK, he made the same statement. If you tell anyone, I'll fucking kill you. Under these circumstances, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in determining that these two robberies were part of a schematic whole and ruled that joinder was proper.
Well, could you address the argument that your opposing counsel made that the evidence in one case was a lot stronger than the evidence in the other case and it could have influenced the verdict on the weaker case?
Certainly. The people's position is there was no improper bolstering effect as between the evidence in these two cases. Now, that argument, as I understand it, is based on the fact that SK was unable to identify Mr. Solani before trial. Now, even without that pretrial identification, the evidence in that case showed that all of SK's stolen property was found in Solani's motel room. Solani called his then estranged wife and told her, and I quote, I stabbed a white ass lawyer in the neck and took his briefcase. That's at page 829 of the record. With those pieces of evidence, the people contend that the evidence of the aggravated robbery was in fact overwhelming, even though SK was unable to identify him before trial. Now, the evidence of the simple robbery where Solani took MH's cell phone, that would not have had a bolstering effect on this other evidence that Solani says, I stabbed this guy in the neck and took his briefcases, and lo and behold, the briefcases were then found in his motel.
Was there any effort to impeach the testimony of the ex-wife based on domestic hostilities, as Mr. Burkhardt suggested?
I don't recall from the record whether or not that happened. But I think that would be a matter of weight for the jury to determine when they make their determination of whether or not to accept the wife's testimony. Unless there are any further questions regarding joinder, I'll move on to the race justi issue. As Mr. Borquist said, this evidence happened at the Banfield Pet Hospital. We refer to it as the Banfield incident in the briefs. And this evidence was admitted to give the jury a full understanding of the crime spree that Solani engaged in. Now, this evidence explains the crime spree, because it tells how Mr. Solani began his day by making threatening calls from his cell phone to his then estranged wife. It continued when he harassed her and her co-workers at the animal hospital. It escalated when he then slashed a police cruiser's tires in the Banfield parking lot. Now, all of this evidence shows that he was making calls from his cell phone. The record also shows that when the then estranged wife reported this incident to the police called Mr. Solani's cell phone and instructed him to stop harassing the people at the animal hospital. Based on that evidence, the record shows that Solani knew both his estranged wife and the police had his cell phone number. It stands to reason, therefore, that when he stole MH's cell phone, he was looking for a device by which to make phone calls from which the number would not be recognized. Therefore, the res justa evidence gives context to the simple robbery. In addition, the fact that that Solani slashed the tires of the police cruiser at the animal hospital parking lot shows that he and nobody else slashed SK's tires. Accordingly, this incident was properly admitted as res justa because it did give the jury a full and complete understanding of the robberies. Nor was this evidence unfairly prejudicial. It was relevant, and relevant evidence, by its very nature, is prejudicial. But it was not of such a character that would create an overmastering hostility towards Mr. Solani or would introduce considerations extraneous to the merits for the jury.
Why did the prosecution even need that whole incident involving the hospital?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, it gave the jury context to explain why Solani would barge into the 7-Eleven, grabbing it in NH's wrist, and take her cell phone. That incident by itself would be difficult, perhaps, for the jury to understand without the context of knowing that Mr. Solani had been making calls from his cell phone, knowing that the police had his cell phone number, and perhaps Solani did not want to be traced by that cell phone number. With MH's phone, from which he did make calls to his ex-wife later in the evening, that explains why that simple robbery would have taken place.
So that evening, the record shows he used the stolen cell phone.
Correct. No, I apologize. I believe I have record sites in my brief to when those phone calls were made, but I don't have them at hand right now. Unless this court has any further questions about the res justa issue, I will briefly touch on the prosecutor's comments and then rest. The prosecutor in this case said that its evidence was unrebutted. Mr. Borges alleges that this was prosecutorial misconduct and that it shifted the burden. This is incorrect. In the trial, the defense put on one witness, Robert Solani, who was the defendant's brother. He testified about his involvement in going to Mr. Solani's motel room the day after the robberies and putting stuff into storage. Robert also testified to the fact that Solani sometimes wore glasses and sometimes shaved his head. That testimony was 4 pages in the record, from pages 1000 to 1004 in the record. It did not, in fact, rebut any of the prosecution's evidence concerning the robberies. Accordingly, in its closing argument, the prosecution said, "This evidence is unrebutted." The prosecution also underscored the fact that Mr. Solani had the right to remain silent, does not have to testify at all. The prosecution was not shifting the burden or even attempting to shift the burden here. Accordingly, the comments were proper. Unless this court has any further questions about any of the issues, the people will request that the conviction be affirmed.
In terms of the burden shifting argument, are we stuck with Santini, or is Santini limited to its facts, which was a burden shifting argument in the context of an expert witness?
I think the principles of Santana apply here. I don't think it was limited to its facts. Santana set forth several factors that any court should apply in reviewing whether a burden is shifted. And those include whether the prosecution...
Wouldn't we be better off with a bright line test, such as has evolved in closing arguments that use the word lie, that either you can do it or you can't do it?
Well, I think the Constitution and the existing body of law in Colorado and across the country is clear that the prosecution may not shift the burden of proof.
Well, but my question is a little more subtle. Wouldn't we be better off with a bright line test that either says a prosecutor can say, can argue to the jury, my case was unrebutted, or the prosecutor can't say that, just like the prosecutor can't say, and that if somebody lied?
I don't know that a bright line rule would be appropriate, because these things are inherently fact-driven and based on what does or does not occur at trial. I think articulating a bright line rule specifying it's black or it's white would not necessarily serve the interests of justice in a situation like this. Accordingly, I think the Santana factors are a better way of promoting justice and determining whether or not misconduct has occurred.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'll be very brief. I just want to touch on, starting with the last point made by the Assistant Attorney General, regarding Judge Webb's remarks about a bright line rule. I don't think that that's unworkable, because with regard to use of the word liar or lying, I think that's worked out. In other words, there is a bright line there, and people know, you know, enough not to cross that line, and I think it could work as well with regard to a burden shifting issue. A couple of other points I just wanted to touch on. The tire slashing at the Banfield Peck Hospital, and the tire slashing on South University Boulevard. Like trial counsel for Mr. Solani said at the time of argument on the joinder issue, when arguing that the Banfield incident should not have been allowed. There's nothing unique about tire slashing. Tire slashing happens, unfortunately, more frequently than we'd like to think. The other thing,
but
other
is, point, isn't the test for race gesti much lower than would be the common scheme plan or design test for 404B, which it seems to be would be more consistent with your argument unique modus operandi? Or,
I think I concede that, Your Honor, that the test is lower for race gesti. The last thing I wanted to address was the people's position that there was not bolstering between these two cases, combining the two robbery cases. It's our position that there was, because I think from the juror's perspective, a juror could have looked at this and said, well, maybe SK, you know, didn't, the defendant wasn't the guy who got SK on South University Boulevard. But here we have MH, and she's 85 to 99% certain. She was 85% certain at the time of the pretrial identification. By the time of trial, I think it was 95 to 99% certain. And a juror could look at this and say, what are the odds that they're both wrong in both cases, that the prosecution is wrong in both cases? And that's how there would be a bolstering. So, if there are no other questions, thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.